So once again, welcome everybody to the last of our Megillas Esther mini-series we're doing tonight. We've seen Achashverosh, we've seen Vashti, we've seen Mordechai and Esther, as we've gone on our quick-hitting tour of the major personalities of the Megillah. And we wrap up with Haman. Maybe next year we can come back for more, because there's so much that we're leaving on the table. Like, Megillah is amazing. But I think Haman's going to be a fun one for us to end with. We've had some of the ambiguity of Vashti. We've had some of the complications with the growth of Esther and the growing pains of Esther. And so the last one, hopefully will just be a good fun one. Who doesn't love to learn about Haman and everything we don't want to be? But what exactly is everything we don't want to be? We'll find out. We'll see. Haman is much more than a cartoon villain or just the stand-in for a typical anti-Semite. There really is a lot of there's a lot of relevant evil behind Haman, and I think even really relevant in every generation, ours included. And not just, I think there's a bit of a mistake we make sometimes when we think about Haman, that we just think about, what are the traits of Haman we can identify in our enemies? And I think something that's a little bit scary but very important is to say, are there any traits of Haman we may find in ourselves? And if that's the case, of course, to try to drive those out as relentlessly as possible. So that's the real goal for tonight, is going to be to unpack what exactly is the defining evil of Haman. And Chazal tell us, this is going to be the theme of this week, the Shabbos, the Parsha Zachar, is behind the evil of Haman lies the ultimate evil of Amalek, which we love to talk about, but we never really understand what exactly it is. So hopefully we'll have some constructive insights into that this evening. So a little screen share, and then we will get started. So here we go. So I titled the shiur, everything is worthless, the Avodah Zarah of Haman Amalek. The line I took that from is what I think is one of the pivotal lines of Haman. Haman speaks three times in the Megillah. Once he speaks to Achashverosh, once he speaks to his family, and once he speaks against Achashverosh, when he wants to be rewarded. We'll not look at that one tonight, although we definitely could have. And Haman says, V'chol ze einenu shoveh li. I have everything in the world, but it's all worthless to me. Everything is worthless, as we'll see. That really, really is the defining problem, the defining ideology of Haman. What does Haman value? What does he care about? We know who he hates. We know who he despises. What, if anything, does Haman actually care? That's, I think, a question for us to kind of put on the front burner as we begin the learning today. So the first source I have over here is a Gemara in Megillah. It's a great line in Megillah. I think it's a good place for us to start because it just puts a bow on a number of the themes we've talked about coming into Haman. The Gemara says about Pasuk said about Achashverosh, that Achashverosh made a party, lasos kirtzon ish v'ish. And the goal of the party was to do, as the will of every single person. Everyone gets their own customized drinking option, and Achashverosh is trying to please everybody. And Rava has a line. He has an extraordinarily sharp line, which tells us something about Achashverosh and two other people. Amar Rava, lasos kirtzon, Mordechai v'Haman. Who are the two people that Achashverosh is trying to please? He's trying to please Mordechai and Haman. Where does he get this from? Mordechai d'chsev ish Yehudi. The Megillah describes two people as an ish. One ish, an ish. Normally you translate ish as just a person or a man. But an ish really is usually a person or a being of particular importance. So there are two anashim in the Megillah. One is Mordechai, ish Yehudi, and Haman, ish tsar ve'oyev. Okay, so what is this Gemara getting at over here? It's clearly an insight into Achashverosh. Achashverosh, who, as we saw in our first shir of the series, is somebody who, underneath all the power and glory, is somebody who desperately tries to please everybody. He's somebody who stands for nothing other than, his own desires. But he wants to please Mordechai. He wants to please Haman. Okay, that's what Achashverosh is at the end of the day. He's just trying to get everybody. But who are the two polar opposites we have? Mordechai and Haman. Another Gemara. We've seen a bunch of these, but Chazal keep on coming back to this idea that Haman and Mordechai are the diametric opposites, right? So everything we saw from Mordechai last week, the one person who's identity is clear from beginning to end. The person who is puts his own values above everything else, and Haman are antithetical. But what exactly does it mean to the opposite of Mordechai? Let's begin to unpack. What I want to do, I think we'll have time to look well at two of the three instances where Haman speaks in Megillah. And if we unpack those carefully, we'll really get a good sense of what keeps Haman going, what Haman's all about. We're told in Parak Hey, so you have the Pesukim over here. So this is after Haman and Achashverosh have had the first party with Esther. And the Megillah tells us, "Vayetzei Haman v'yamahu sameach v'tov lev." Right, he left the party joyful and glad of heart. He's not just sameach; he's sameach v'tov lev. He is in a fantastic mood. Haman right now is on top of the world. He has just had a private meal with Esther and with Achashverosh. Part of the irony of the Megillah loves the hidden pieces, the irony. Right, what is the reality? And what's the external reality? Externally, right now, it looks like Haman is on top of the world. The decree is out there to wipe out the Jews. That wasn't supposed to happen. He is having a private meal with the queen and the king who seem to adore him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is out of the picture. But as we know, the real turning point of the Megillah has already taken place. No one knows it. But the fact that Achashverosh extended the scepter to Esther, and Esther has been allowed to come into the throne room and begin already the process of leading to Haman's destruction, we know that that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has re-entered the picture. We know that the process of Geula is already unfolding. Haman is completely oblivious to that, and anybody who is watching externally is oblivious to that as well. Okay, so that's the scene here. Haman thinks he's on top of the world, and everybody else would think that as well, even though they don't realize how wrong they are and how quickly we're going to get to Ibn Ahapa. But then, speaking of Ibn Ahapa, Haman, who is so happy and so glad and has everything in the world he can ever want and need, he sees Mordechai who would not get up, he would not move. Haman al Mordechai chema. Haman was filled with rage. Right, you can see in the Shoresh of Chema is Cham, right, a warmth. It's a fascinating word for anger. So he's filled with fire red anger. Not the first time that's happened, but we'll come back to that. So Haman is like, you know, completely turned around. Okay. Vayesapak Haman. But Haman refrains himself. He goes back to his friend, his loved ones, and his wife, Zeresh. Okay, then he tells them, "Vayseper lehem Hamanas kavod ashro rov banav." He tells them all the things he has. He has his money. He has all his children. Veis kol asher gidlo amelach, his whole promotion. Veis kol asher niso, how high he was raised. Al sarim avdei amelach, he's of all the other officers and officials. And then Haman says, right, even Esther didn't invite anybody except for me. After all that, he says, V'chol ze inenu shovali, none of this is worth anything to me. V'chol eis asher ani ro'eh es Mordechai Yehudi, yoshev b'shar hamalach. Everything I have is worthless as long as I see Mordechai the Jew. So we have this Haman, who we see goes from feeling ecstatic on top of the world to being plunged into the depths of rage. So already we can see that anger is a defining character trait of Haman. We'll have to figure out how that plays into the evil that he has, but we see the anger. We also can see by the way, you know what? On that note, actually, we should highlight already the first source they put on here. Another great dig that the Megillah has on Haman. We've seen in the context of three of the personalities we've discussed in the Megillah, Mordechai, Esther, and even Vashti, you know, the one shining moment that Vashti had, the personality of Yosef really just looms large over the entire Megillah. We've discussed this at length. The person who's the personality of Bitachon, the person who's able to survive and thrive even in the exile, the first generation where there's no prophecy, what does life with HaKadosh Baruch Hu look like when there no longer is direct communication? We had all the many, many, many parallels between Esther, the young orphan in the palace, and Yosef. We have Mordechai you know, the exile who becomes the second to the king and Yosef. Well, the Megillah can't help but give us a little Yosef link to Haman of all people as well. But it's so great how the Megillah does it, because this link to Yosef is one which just makes fun of Haman, right? This word, Vayisapak, he refrained himself. So that specific phrase, that specific word, only appears one other time in the entire Tanakh. And the Shoresh itself is a key word in the whole Yosef narrative. We're told back in Parshas Mikates, by Meher Yosef, Yosef in Parshas Mikates is overwhelmed with mercy for his brothers. He wants to cry. And then what happens? He runs outside. He weeps. He washes his face. Vayis apak. He controls himself. He masters the surge of emotion. He comes back to everybody else and he says, put bread on the table. So we have the Vayis apak of Yosef. Two people in history are Vayis apak. One is Yosef, who's controlling all the mercy which is pouring out of himself. And we have the Vayis apak of Haman, who is desperately trying to control his furious rage. But ultimately, ultimately, when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, he's not able to withhold all of the emotion he has. What's great about this word the Megillah is using, though, is by putting Yosef up there, right next to Haman. So, like, what did Haman do? Yosef held down the emotion of being sold as a slave, 12 years in prison, being reunited with his brothers, the love and the mercy which is coming out for them. It is an unbelievable display of self-control that Yosef is trying to put on for all of Parshas Mikates. It's like a superhuman exhibition of emotional discipline that we see from Yosef in Parshas Mikates. And then finally, he hits the breaking point when it's like the most emotional moment in all of history, when Yehuda comes forward and just it all comes together. Finally, that was the point where Yosef hits the breaking point. What's the one other place where Tanakh uses this word? Vayisapak Haman. What is the unbelievable restraint that Haman has? What is, oh my gosh, look how disciplined he is. Let go and control. His emotions are surging forth, but he's able to master it and get control of his emotions. The fact that Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him as he left the queen's palace. This is somebody whose ego and whose anger is so out of control that something which should be ridiculously easy to do, it requires a superhuman level of effort from Haman, which is supposed to be analogized to that of Yosef HaTzadik. Right? So we have Mordechai and Esther, who are the true comparisons to Yosef. And then the Megillah here just gives us a deeply ironic link between Haman and Yosef. Yeah, we have the restraint of Yosef, and look at the restraint of Haman, this egomaniacal, rage-filled person who's desperately, look at him, controlling himself by holding it in. And by the way, how long does he hold it in for? Vayisapak Haman vayavo el beiso. He holds it in until he gets home. This was a 15-minute car ride for Haman from the palace to his house. 15 minutes, he's able to keep it together. Very good. Right? Everyone give a big clap for Haman's emotional discipline and restraint over here. Okay, so now we see, we're getting a sense of the rage and the ego. And the ego, it's incredible. What is Haman telling his family? He's talking about his money, his rov banav, his position. Who is he talking to? This is not a TED talk where everyone is being introduced for the first time to this person, Haman ben Hammedatha. He's talking to his closest people. Imagine ever coming home and getting, okay, you get the spouse together, you get the kids together, and you say, okay, everybody, I need to tell you, here is how my bank account is doing, and here's how much I've been promoted at work, and here's how great, here are all the things I've accomplished in life. Everyone sit here and listen to me talk about all the things that I've accomplished. Haman has to do that. He has this need, right, to tell everybody about everything else. Oh, you don't even know, Esther was the one who invited me and the king. Like, nobody else in the house knows. It was Haman together with Esther and Ahasuerus. He has this desperate need for kavod. And if there's anything that is in his way, the chol zeh einenu shoveli, right? As he desperately talks about everything he has, it's all worthless. The chol eis asher ani ro'eh, es Mordechai ha-Yehudi, Yoshev Bishar HaMelech. Haman needs it all and needs everyone to recognize he has it all. The ego is out of control. The anger is out of control. And if he doesn't have one thing his way, right, the one thing is Mordechai won't bow down. It's all nothing to him. Zeresh's wife tells him, Yasu Eitz Gavoa Chamishim Amah, right? Make a very tall gallows. And in the morning, you'll get Mordechai killed. Okay. Now, the Gemara has two midrashim I wanted to focus on. One is a midrash Tanhuma, which just crystallizes some of what we're talking about Haman, his character flaw, and then a mysterious Gemara in Chum. The midrash, there are a number of these. I just put the midrash Tanhuma here in Mishpatim, but I could have done like a bunch of others. Points out that there are two people that we know who live life very extraordinarily wealthy people in Tanakh, and it doesn't work out for them. As Medrash says, we have Korach and Haman. Ish osher shamur lebaalav letovah. So there are people who hold on to fantastic wealth, and that's a good thing, or pro savings accounts. Ish osher shamur lebaalav lerasa. There are people who hold on to their money, and it is just to their detriment. Shemor the ba'alav the rasa, people who hoard and hoard and hoard wealth, and it just ends up being bad. Ze ashrosh shel Korach. First, we're told about Korach. Korach the man was fantastically rich. Chazal say he was the richest Jew in all of Klal Yisrael. What happens to all his money? All the money goes down into the ground. Ashrosh shel Haman. So what happens to all of Haman's fantastic wealth? In the end, Haman's executed. His money's all given to Mordechai and to Esther. Now Chazal put these two people together. Korach and Haman, what they share is they have so much. Chazal also, by the way, talk about Korach's wife giving him bad advice. But they have so much. They're given and given, but they need more. The greed is there. I have so much and I need more. So we can talk about Haman's rage. We can talk about Haman's need for honor, and we can talk about Haman's greed. I have everything. Korach is rich. Korach, I think the Chazal say, is in charge of carrying the Aron. One thing he needs to be higher than Moshe Rabbeinu. And so he goes to be even higher, and he ends up falling as far as you can go. Haman, he's rich. He's the second to the king. Everyone else has to bow down to him. But he needs Mordechai, that one thing he needs, and it leads to his destruction. And this probably explains what the Gemara means. The Gemara in Chulin says, Haman min HaTorah minayin. The Gemara asks a source for a number of people from the Torah. Some are easier to understand than others. And it says, how do you know about Haman from the Torah? So the Gemara answers, Hamin ha'etz. What does it mean, Hamin ha'etz? So the Pasuk in Bereishis, when Hashem says to Adam HaRishon, Hamin ha'etz asher tibisicha levilti achal mimenu achalta. Did you eat from the tree? Hamin ha'etz. So what exactly does the Gemara mean? It's obviously not like a literal pshat. I mean, Haman himself is not directly talked about in the Torah. We're trying to find a reference. We're trying to find an asmachta, but something of particular depth. And Chazal talk about this image of the Eitz Hadas. What does this have to do with Haman? So Rashi gives the literal pshat. I'm pretty sure this is what Rashi means. You vowelize this as Hamin. Ha'etz, but Rashi says, no, Haman ha'etz, yitla al ha'etz. So Haman, who's on the tree. I think what Rashi, the image Rashi is telling you, is that there's a Haman tree. Once Haman gets hung on a tree, so you could have, apples hang from apple trees, and oranges hang from orange trees, and Hamans hang from Haman trees. So we're going to have a Haman tree. The Haman tree. Okay. So that's fun. But I've heard a couple of people actually in the last 2 weeks mention this idea. I don't know. Right. It's clearly shot, I think. I heard Meir Simcha Shtomer talk about this a couple weeks ago. Let's talk with Rabbi Nachum Rosenbaum about this. So the Kol alumni all came out in force to talk about this Gemara. The clear meaning of the deeper meaning, I think, of what we're talking about here is Adam has the same situation as Haman, right? He has it all. He's in Gan Eden. He's given everything he could possibly ever want. There's one thing that Adam and Rishon can't have. One thing he can't have is the fruit from the Eitz Hadas. Haman, it's the same story. He's given all, but he needs that one extra thing. And that one extra thing he needs to have, it leads to his downfall. And we can push this farther, by the way, because the Adam doesn't even last, Adam and Chava can't even last one day in Gan Eden. Right? Within the first day, it's already gone. By the time, you know, they're created on Friday and ready on Shabbos, they're eating from the tree. Haman couldn't wait a day. Right? Haman sees Mordechai, and then he has to go straight immediately that night to the palace. If he had just waited until the morning and hadn't gone at 3-4 o'clock in the morning knocking on Ahasuerus's door, he would have gotten what he needed. But it's that he needs the one thing he can't have, and he needs it immediately. He can't even wait. We also could point out that both Adam and Haman, right? Their wife is involved in the plot. You know, so it's when you find somebody who's doing sins, often you find that their spouse fits. So Zeresh was the one who gave the suggestion, the tree related suggestion to Haman. And Zeresh gave the tree related suggestion to Haman. And Chava gave the tree related suggestion to Adam. Hey, eat from the fruit. It's a little bit cute. This last point I was thinking, Adam wanted to take the one thing off the fruit that wasn't supposed to be there, and Haman wants to put something on the fruit, on the tree. It's not supposed to be there. You know, he wants to put Mordechai on the tree. It doesn't work out for him. But the core piece that comes out of the Gemara here is just crystallizing this idea that Haman, and we see this coming out of the Pesukim, he has so much. He feels the need to tell us that he has so much, but Hamin ha'etz asher tzivisichel v'tiyach cholimenu. He wants it all. He wants to go after Mordechai. And then what's going to happen a couple of prakim after this? Two prakim after this, Zeresh all of a sudden is going to turn around and say to Haman, if you had started off with any of the other 127 nations, you would have had no problem at all. But of all the enemies you had to pick on B'nai Yisrael. The one thing you couldn't have, the one you couldn't destroy was B'nai Yisrael, was Mordechai HaYehudi. That's the one you had to go after, and it is going to lead to your total destruction. So we have the rage, we have the ego, we have the desperate need for cover. All of this is also highlighted in the first instance where we see Haman in Perek Gimel. And from here, we can begin to take things even deeper and try to understand where the Amalek connection comes to. Why are we talking at all about Amalek this Shabbos? So we go back to Perek Gimel. I decided it was better to do this a little bit out of order. And the Megillah tells us, right, Gidal HaMelech HaChashverosh Es Haman Ben Hamadasa HaAgagi. So he raises Haman, right? And he raised him up again. So the Megillah is really emphasizing this rapid promotion of Haman. There's a Gidal, there's a being promoted, there's a Vayanaseyu, he's being lifted up. And he was thrown, was lifted up above all the other officers. So we have three different promotions that are described in a single pasuk. He's being taken from, I don't know where exactly, but somewhere low down. But if you're going to get three levels of promotion in one pasuk, that means that before this happened, Haman was not the number three man. And he didn't get a promotion from the number three guy in the government to the number two guy in the government. He was taken from somewhere very low and raised up very high. The pshat probably is that Ahasuerush does this, you know, and actually a number of the modern Mepharshim point this out, that Ahasuerush does this as a response to the Big Son and Zeresh episode. The near assassination of Ahasuerus from his own personal guards. After this happens, I think we never ever see Ahasuerus leave the palace, right? He's on any conversation he has with somebody is only within the grounds of the palace. The most he's ever going to do is he's going to take a walk into his garden, but that's basically it. We know that after this, if you want to have an audience with Ahasuerus, security is tight. Shot is that Haman now becomes the man in charge. You know, you have to go through Haman. And that's a response. That's the new security policy that's in place over here. But Chazal are also aware of the fact that Haman is being promoted from somewhere very low to somewhere very high. I'm sure there's more to say about this. We should appreciate that Chazal see Haman really fitting in with the other cast of characters in the Megillah. Not to get into the whole story, but it's the last line over here. The Gemara tells us that Haman was a barber for 22 years. Haman safar shal kfar kartzum haya esr mishtayim shana. He was a barber, okay? So we're not talking about the former, you know, undersecretary of state or somebody who had a nice dignified job somewhere in the bureaucracy. He's a blue-collar guy. And Haman himself was probably a thug, right? That's what attracts Ahasuerus to him. He's going to put everybody in their place and hold everybody down. But that idea that Haman comes from a very low station. And now we have Ahasuerus, who spends the whole Megillah compensating for the fact that he doesn't really have legitimate royal blood. We talked about that a few weeks ago. We have Haman now, his partner in crime. Haman, who also needs to compensate. Part of the ego that he has, this desperate need to fill himself with other people's honor, is because of the fact that he comes from a lower place. He may have lineage from Agag, but Agag has not been king for several centuries. It's no longer really going to do very much on your resume. It's kind of gotten stale. Okay, Megillah continues. Everybody was there. We know they had to bow down to Haman because that's what the king commanded. Mordechai wouldn't do it. Those two terms, bow, of Korea, means going down on his knees. And then yishtachaveh means you bring your head down to the floor. Now the Marikra points out something. This is just, it's something we should appreciate. I didn't really realize it at all until I prepared this this shiur. You know, the way we always think of what happens, and I think I should have brought it here, like the art scroll illustrated Megillah, is Haman walks down the street, and the image you have is everybody has to bow down as Haman walks by, and it is extremely conspicuous that Mordechai, of all the people there, does not bow down, right? And he literally sticks out like a sore thumb. If you read the Pesukim, though, that's not actually what happens. So first we're told that Mordechai wouldn't bow down. All the other servants of the king tell him, why aren't you obeying the king's law? And they would tell this to Mordechai every single day. We discussed a couple of weeks ago, this is one of the Yosef parallels over here, the exact same phrase that's taken from Yosef's ignoring the advances of Potiphar's wife. Day after day, Vahiba Amram Elav Yom Yom Belo Shema Alehem, ignoring the daily appeals. So telling him day after day, bow down to Haman, bow down to Haman, bow down to Haman. Vayagidu the Haman, their oath, Hayamidu, Ayamdu Devrei Mordechai, ki Yigidu Lahem Asher Hu Yehudi. They, the other servants of the king, tell Haman. Haman does not see on his own. He is alerted to that. Mordechai is ratted out by the other Avdei HaMelech, who apparently want to see, is Mordechai really going to be true to his word? Mordechai is claiming a religious exemption. He's saying, I cannot bow down to Haman because of my religious beliefs, which we'll need to explain what exactly that is. So they are skeptical. They rat Mordechai out to Haman. And then, Vayar Haman, ki ein Mordechai, kriya mishtacha ve'lo, v'ymelei Haman, chima. Once Haman is told about this, then he looks, and then when he sees Mordechai doesn't bow down, he's filled with rage. Marikra points this out. It was only after he was told. At first, he thought, it was only after he was told. Now, how is that possible? So we need to understand what the proper visualization should be. Ahasuerus's law is not that every Tom, Dick, and Harry needs to bow down to Haman. The law specifically was the chol avdei hamelach. The other officials, the other royal officials. Avdei HaMelech doesn't mean the king's subjects. It doesn't mean the king's citizens. It means the king's officials. That's why these people are supposed to be in the Sha'ar HaMelech. So it wasn't like Haman went down the street to get, some groceries, and everybody there has to fall down on their face as they see Haman walk by. The idea of the law is something very clear. Ahasuerus wants to emphasize that Haman is in charge of all the other officers and officials. And therefore, it is specifically the royal officials who are the ones who have to bow down. Slightly ironically, if you are a regular civilian, the law doesn't apply to you. We don't need to stop the whole city as Haman walks by. The law only applies to Ahasuerus's servants, the high officials. That's why Mordechai does not stand out. Mordechai has no need to stand out in the crowd. He is very happy for people to not notice that he is one of the Avdei HaMelech, that he sits in the Sha'ar HaMelech. He has some position. It's never clarified what exactly it was. But the Megillah makes very clear that Mordechai had some position of importance in the royal court. But Mordechai is more than happy enough to blend into the background, to blend into the crowd. It is the other servants who see what's happening, and they rat Mordechai out. Haman never even noticed. Now that makes, on one hand, highlights a contrast between Mordechai and Haman. Haman, who needs the honor, needs the glory, and Mordechai, who is just happy to fit invisibly into the background. It also makes Haman's rage even more egregious. It was not a disrespectful act of defiance, of public, you know, a public show by Mordechai. I'm going to show them that I'm not going to bow down to Haman. That's not what it was. It was a private act, which if Haman had never been shown about it, he never would have noticed. But once Haman does notice, what was not, you know, totally obviously offensive to him, just like we saw in Perek Hay, when he said, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli, everything I have, if I have 99.999%, that's not enough. That we see here in Perek Gimel as well. And the same phrase is used, the same exact phrase, V'ymalei Haman chima. He was filled with wrath. We have that in Perek Hay. We have that in Perek Gimel. Dot Mikra points out, I think I have it over here. Yes, I do. They point out, Lashon Nimla chima, Lashon chazakama, or Lomatina Lashon Azot. We never find this anywhere in Tanakh, this line of being filled with rage, except for Haman. Haman is being described as having the worst temper of any personality we've ever seen in the Tanakh. So he's desperate for the kavod. He needs everybody to be bowing down for him. And as soon as one person doesn't do so, and in a way which isn't even that obvious, he totally flips his lid. Okay. Fine. Now, the question is, of course, why exactly wasn't Mordechai bowing down? This is the one that all the Mepharshim deal with. Rashi is the one who really gives the initial pshat. We need to understand what it means. And this is going to give us yet another insight into Haman. And this will begin to get us onto the Amalek piece. So Rashi says, Kor Meshtachavim, we know this. Sha'asa atzmo le'el. Not a kale, but an ale. And Haman made himself into a god. Rashi here is quoting the Gemara in Megillah on Daf Yud Mabez. As I'll talk about a couple of times about this idea of Haman making himself into a god. We need to understand what that means. It probably does not mean, and almost definitely in fact does not, that Haman truly thought of himself as deity. It means that Haman demands to be given the honor as if he was a god. Chazal talks somewhere else about Haman hanging a tzelem from his chest. In that case, he's using the idolatry to get even more kavod for himself. The analogy here, what this is drawing on, is a previous time in Tanakh where we saw everybody have to bow down. In the third parak of Sefer Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar makes a massive golden statue. Everyone has to bow down to it. We know Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow down. It's a clear parallel between the behavior of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, and over here, Mordechai, who refuses to bow down to Haman. Rabbeinu Tam, already in Tosfos over there, argues, and this probably is the pshat in the pasuk, that that statue was not an idol. Mefarsh Rabbeinu Tam, the tzelem zeh she'asa Nebuchadnezzar, lav avodah zarah, ala indarta she'asa lechbod atzmo. It was a massive statue representing Nebuchadnezzar himself. Everybody is bowing down to the glory of Nebuchadnezzar. They have to treat Nebuchadnezzar, venerate him as if he was a god. But the whole project is not to literally worship Nebuchadnezzar as if he's a god. The point is to take all the worship that is given to the gods and give it to the king Nebuchadnezzar for his own personal honor and glory. It's like a 1 minute, you know, tangent for what's happening over there in Sefer Daniel in the previous parak and parak base. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. He didn't know what it was. Daniel tells him, good news. I'll tell you the dream. I'll tell you what it means. Another Yosef parallel. And he tells him, you dreamed you had, you saw a giant statue. The head of the statue was made of gold. The chest was made of silver. The thighs were made of bronze. And the legs were made of, the stomach was made of bronze, sorry. The legs were made first of iron, then of iron mixed with clay. And then ultimately the whole thing was destroyed by a little rock, which became a mountain. Little rock that becomes a mountain is B'nai Yisrael. The statue is the various empires under which we suffer. The golden head of the statue. So Daniel tells him, Nebuchadnezzar, that's you. Okay, the good news is you get to be the golden head, but you're not going to be the last empire of all time. Your empire is going to fall. It's going to be replaced by the Persian Empire, Paras Umadai, which is silver. It's got two arms, right? Parasu Madai. That's going to be followed by a couple of other ones. The Mefarshim disagrees with what exactly those are. But ultimately, everything is going to be destroyed. Mashiach is going to come. Bnei Yisrael are going to be on top. So Nebuchadnezzar gets that dream in Perek Beis. So what does he do in Perek Gimel? He says, I'm going to build a giant statue, but the whole thing is going to be gold. You know, so there's no gold head and then a different empire, silver, and then a different empire, bronze, a different empire, iron. No, all gold. It's going to be all Babel, all Nebuchadnezzar, all the time. It's never going to be destroyed. There's not going to be any other kingdom. Everyone's going to go bow down. I'm going to send a message to Daniel. Look, you know, Hashem, you think that you can send me a message. I'll send you a message in return. We're here for all time. Watch everybody bow down to me. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar tangent over. Back to Haman, who Rashi is telling us, the Gemara is telling us, Haman is doing the exact same thing. He is demanding the honor and the veneration as if he was a god. Right. And he's not getting it. Now, this idea of Avodah Zarah. So what does Haman worship? We're gonna see, and this will link to Amalek in a minute. Haman doesn't have a god. Haman worships himself. Haman worships himself. And the Rambam is already aware of the link between somebody who's filled with rage and somebody who's engaged in Avodah Zarah. The Rambam says, the classic line, Hilchos Deos, Amar Chachamim, Arishonim, Kol HaKoes, Kiilu, Ovid Avodah Chachamim. Anybody who gets angry, it's as if he worships idolatry. Why? Because at the end of the day, what does anger stand for? You hold yourself up so high that if things don't go the way you want, you go nuts. You lose your mind. The Rambam is getting this from the Gemara in Shabbos, which is somebody who tears his clothes in rage, or he breaks his stuff in rage, or he throws his money around in rage, which Haman is about to do when he offers 10,000 silver kikar tzachashverosh. Yihi be'enecha ka'oved avodah zar. Haman worships himself, and he demands that everyone else do that as well. The rage, the ego, the insatiable desire for more and more and more and more, it all comes from worship of the self. Okay? Now, we're up to this, so we can't ignore it. There's an awesome insight that the Dot Mikra has. This is not really so much, you know, I love this. It's not the kind of thing that they usually do. I thought it was extremely, extremely sharp. You know, talking about Haman, as somebody who his god is himself. So he casts the lottery, right? In Parashat Pasuk Zayin. We got to read this Pasuk carefully. It's such a great, I love this. So Pasuk said, B'chodesh HaRishon L'chodesh Nisan. In the first month, he casts the lottery, right? He pilpu ha'garel. Miyom liyom mi'chodesh l'chodesh. The lottery went from day to day, from month to month. Shnei masar chodesh adar. What does it mean the lottery went from month to month until it got to Adar? So that Mikra points out, there was a clear message to Haman from the way the lottery happens that the plan is not going to work. Why? Because how does a lottery work? The way you do a lottery, the way you do a goro, is you have, it's all yes or no. So you take, so Haman is standing in the month of Nisan, first month. And Haman says, okay, goro, poor, is this the month to wipe out the Jews? No. Okay. Iyar, the next month. Is this the month to kill the Jews? No. On the third month, Sivan, is this the month to kill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, he gets to the 12th month. The 12th month apparently never even came up as the lottery, they're pointing out in the Pshat and the Psukim. Haman goes, no, 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 no. Okay. Must be that it is the 12th month. It's a great, great point. Hagarol dachev ad hachodesh acharon chadash adar v'yom yuchad lo nebar lo klal. There's never any points where he's given a specific day from the lottery. The lottery itself, Haman should be getting the message, right, that there is a higher power here. This is not going to succeed, but Haman doesn't see it. Right? There is no, Haman doesn't, he doesn't even believe in chance. Right? Often we say, okay, they believe in chance. He believes in himself and that's it. He gets the messages and he ignores the messages. Oh, it was just, you know, it was a one in 12 chance right there. That's the day that we're going to have. Okay. There's one other piece to understand about the Titanic rage of, the Titanic rage of Haman, which is that he then goes, and of course he doesn't only make this a personal issue between himself and Mordechai, but this becomes like a national issue. He's going to wipe out all of the Jews because of like the one personal beef he has with Mordechai. It's astonishing. But underlying some of this maybe is Chazal of the line. I just want to take a minute to understand it if we're going to cover Haman, that Memuchan and Haman are the same person. Remember Memuchan, the advisor to Achashverosh in Perek Aleph, who advised him to kill Vashti. So the Gemara says that Memuchan was Haman. Why is he called Memuchan? Shemuchan lePuranus. He's prepared for punishment. All Haman does is punish. He never builds. He never adds. He never contributes. The Tam Mikra, they have really, really good stuff. What can I say? So they pointed out over here as well that there's a basic structural similarity between the advice that Memuchan gives to Achashverosh to get rid of Vashti and the advice that Haman gives to Achashverosh to get rid of Mordechai. First, you start off with the problem for the king, right? You got a problem with Vashti, and it's a national problem, right? That it's, you got a problem with Vashti, and Haman says you got a problem with this nation, the red. Then the solution. Solution is the punishment. And the punishment is even written semi-euphemistically, possibly. Lo savo Vashti l'tnei melech Achashverosh. She shouldn't come before the king. According to the view that Achashverosh is executed, that Vashti is executed, that's a euphemism. Also, could it be she's banished? Well, same story with Haman. Hamelach tov yikasev l'abdan. If it is good for the king, right? Same line. Im hamelach tov yikasev. Im hamelach tov yikasev. It should be written. Get rid of him. It's interesting, right? Haman doesn't say laharog, lahashmid, lahabed. It says they should be lost. We should get rid of them. And then the third thing he does in each case is he gives the payoff, right? You do this and you'll get 10,000 kikar kesef. You get rid of Vashti, and it's going to help you with all the women in the kingdom being loyal to their husbands, right? So there's this basic structural similarity in terms of the three stages of the advice. What they don't point out, which is also clearly the case, though, is that both in the Memuchan passage and in the subsequent Haman passage, they're taking what was a personal beef, a personal conflict, and blowing it up into a massive national issue. Achashverosh, your problem with Vashti is not just a problem between a man and his wife. It is a massive question, who's going to win in this story, the men or the women? And we need to put Vashti in her place because otherwise the titanic struggle between the men of Persia and the women of Persia, the women are going to win, right? So Memuchan is taking what was a private fight, and he's making it a massive national conflict. That's exactly what Haman does as well. He has a personal issue with Mordechai. He, in all of his rage and all of his ego, it doesn't suffice for it to just be a one person against me. It has to become a titanic war on the whole entire nation whose ideology that they will not bow down to somebody for even resembling a Avodah Zarah, that cannot be tolerated, not even from Mordechai, not even from the whole nation. Okay. So now we can transition to understand the Amalek aspect over here. I think we have a pretty good perspective on Haman, the greed, the rage, the ego, everything insatiable, someone who's filled with rage by Malay, Haman Chema, Hamin Ha'etz. He has everything in the world, but he needs that one more thing, Chazal pointing out to us. It's not just about Mordechai, it's about the whole nation, and he's ignoring the messages that he should be getting. Now the question is, where exactly does Amalek come into this, besides for Haman being an Agagi? The answer is that Amalek is the, as far as I can tell, the only atheistic nation that's around Bnei Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. I put a box here of all the nations around Israel whose gods are referenced in Tanakh. They all have them. Canaan has gods that the Tanakh references. Mitzrayim, obviously, definitely the Elohei Mitzrayim, Eseshvatim, right? The 10th plague. Hashem says, I'm going to destroy the gods of Egypt. Egypt is obsessed with gods, the wrong ones, but they're obsessed with them. Ammon and Moab, Edom and Midian, the Plishtim. Then we go to the north, Aram, Sidon and Lebanon, Ashur and Babel, the empires which are against us. We see all their gods, all the gods of all the nations which are immediately surrounding Eretz Yisrael that we deal with in the time of the Bias Rishon or before. The only exception is Amalek. I mean, just think for a second. You know, if we would visualize a map of the state of Israel, so you have Egypt would be, you know, over here in the southwest, right? Then you'd have Midian, where Saudi Arabia is basically, Edom, Ammon, and Moab by the Transjordan. You'd have Sidon in Lebanon, the Plishtim in the Gaza Strip. You'd have Aram in Syria, Ashur and Bavel in Syria and Iraq. That's all the nations around Israel. The only one which isn't mentioned is Amalek. Seems like Amalek has no gods. I don't believe in one. This theme appears again and again. Whenever Amalek shows up in Tanakh as something super important, invariably the appearance of Amalek and the withdrawal of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are linked. So, for example, Parash B'Shalach, we're told, immediately before Amalek shows up, so when Bnei Yisrael are upset about the water, not there, the lack of water, Masim Riva, they say, Hayesh Hashem Bekarbenu M'ayin, is God with us, is he not? Boom! Vayavo Amalek. In Shalach, this one is often overlooked, the time where Amalek attacks. Right after the sin of the spies, of the Meraglim, Bnei Yisrael are told it's going to be 40 years, you're not going to get into Eretz Yisrael. They immediately have regret. It's really one of the most tragic moments in the Chumash, where after being begged by Moshe and Aaron and the Yeshua and Kalev to ignore the Meraglim, and they cry and cry and cry, the very next day, when they're told they're not going to be able to get in, they do a total 180, they beg, let us go in, we'll go in right now. We'll attack. We're not afraid. We'll attack the Canaanim. We'll go right now. Moshe tells him, don't go. Al talu. Ki ein Hashem bekir b'chem. Hashem is not with you. Ki ha'amaleki va'aknani sham lifneichem unfaltem acharet. Who's going to appear once again? Amalek and Canaan. It's so interesting. Amalek is a small desert band. Canaan is a massive, sophisticated seven nation. And yet the Torah mentions Amalek first. Because when Hashem is not there, Amalek invariably shows up. All right, we're going to read for Zachor. Asher korcha baderech. Right, they happened upon you on the road. And Rashi has to say derech mikra. The whole ideology of Amalek is opposed to not just HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but if you believe in chance, then you don't believe in an Egyptian god. You don't believe in a Plishti god. You don't believe in a Babylonian god. They don't believe in anything. The lo yarei Elokim. They didn't fear anything. When Shaul, at the end of his life, we talk about this, we talk about Rabbi Mordechai and Esther, right? By the end, Shaul begins by being a prophet, right? By the end of Shaul's life, Hashem is gone. Lo no Hashem, lo b'chalamot, lo b'merim, lo b'neviim. Nothing. No dreams, no rumutumim, no prophets. Hashem pulls back from Shaul. Who shows up on the scene? So remember, the Amaleki lad, the Nar Amaleki shows up on the battlefield the minute that Hashem pulls out. And in stark contrast, those who excel out of fighting Amalek, always do so specifically lifnei Hashem, before God. So for some reason, you notice this in Haftorah this week, when Shmuel, after he yells at Shaul, and Shmuel is going to kill Agag, the evil king of Amalek, on his own, for some reason, the Navi needs to tell us that he killed Agag lifnei Hashem. Why does the Navi have to tell us that Shmuel executed Agag before Hashem? It's not in the Mishkan. It's not v'samachta b'chagacha lefnei Hashem elokecha. The answer is, when you fight Amalek, the antidote is specifically to do it before Hashem. When David, in the end of Shmuel Aleph, fights against Amalek, it all starts off with v'yeschazek David b'Hashem elokav. When Hashem leaves the room, Amalek comes in. When we bring Hashem back into the room, then Amalek fails. That's what Chazal are after, the vision of Moshe having his hands up, and in that moment Amalek losing. And then when Moshe's hands are down, Amalek is winning, right? They are the nation which doesn't hold of any God. And when you don't, by the way, when you don't hold of any God, well, who do you worship? You worship yourself, right? That's the cynical use of Avodah Zarah that Haman puts it to. Haman thinks this stuff is all ridiculous, but he'll take the statues. That's the image that Chazal have. He'll take the statues and he'll hang them from the chest if that makes people bow down, right? It's more covered for me. Amalek has no higher value. They have no higher purpose. They have no sense of chesed, we see elsewhere in Tanakh. When you don't believe in anything, all they believe in, the only thing that they value. Going back for a second, I'll scroll up to the title of the shiur. What was it? Everything is worthless. What does Haman value? What does Amalek value? Only and exclusively themselves. They have no higher cause. They have no higher mission. They have no sense of honor. They'll attack vulnerable women and children. They're not embarrassed about the fact that everybody else at least has some basic military ethics and military honor. They have nothing. There is nothing that is valued by them except for themselves. The Avodah Zarah of Haman Amalek. Self-worship. The rage. By Malei Chema. The insatiable need for kavod and for glory. I need more. I need more. I need more. They worship themselves. And self-worship, this guy can be totally atheistic from a certain perspective, but self-worship is 100% Avodah Zarah. And he gets... the message is coming loud and clear from the Goral. You know, it's not coming up the way you want it to. Ignores it. All in it for himself at a radical level, at an unbelievable level. I mean, the fact that he's willing, his morals are so low that he is willing casually to murder an entire nation because of the anger he feels towards one person. It is uncontrolled. Chazal have a beautiful image for Achashverosh and for Haman. This is an image where they assume the two of them are anti-Semites. It's not the image. He had one man there in the Gemara with one man had a pile of dirt and one man had a gaping hole. And so the person with the gaping hole says to the person with the dirt, hey, you know, you give me your dirt and they'll solve both of our problems. So at one level, the Gemara there is talking about Achashverosh, who has all these Jews he wants to get rid of, and Haman, who's able to get rid of them. But that image also describes the character flaws of those two people in the Megillah. Achashverosh, we saw, is the person of excess. He just has too much. There's more. Excess. What's Haman's flaw? Haman feels like a bottomless pit. Now, Chazal were comparing him to Korach before. Haman has this pit that can't be filled. He needs more and more and more. Chol zeh inenu shoveh li. And that is the character trait, right? When you don't stand for something higher than yourself, that is what Haman is all about. And who are the stark contrasts to Haman in this regard? It's Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai, who despite the consequences, despite being warned day after day of what can happen if he ignores the decree of the king, says, absolutely not. I stand for something far greater than some second in command to the Persian king, even though it's not even clear the halacha why this has to be the case. Mordechai is completely committed. I cannot bow down. And there's nothing to do with me. It has to do with something higher. And then in Perek Dalid, as we saw last week, that's the message for Esther. And Esther reads it loud and clear. Kasher avadati avadati. If I am lost, I am lost. But the world is not about me. The world is about what is beyond me. Right? Do you recognize higher causes? Do you recognize something beyond yourself? If you recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you do. You don't. That is Haman on the one extreme, and that is Mordechai and Esther on the other extreme. And just to close, bring things full circle with Haman. So when Haman meets his downfall, the Megillah does an amazing way. It's amazing how Haman. It's just at three different levels we can identify at least the things which turn around. You know, Haman was the person who is defined by insatiable. You know, obviously, you know he tries to hang Mordechai. And he gets hung by Mordechai. Haman is the one with the insatiable rage, and Haman is the one who is destroyed by the king. Now it's the Melech Kam B'Chamaso, right? Haman was the one who'd always been on the dishing end, on the giving end of the Chema, and now he's the victim. Now he's the one on the receiving end of the Chema, okay? Haman no fail al hamita asher Esther Allah. The last position, the last living position we see Haman in, he's falling down on the bed before Esther. The same Haman who in the beginning of the Megillah was insisting on everybody else bowing down before him. And the one person who wouldn't bow down was Mordechai, and that's what drives him nuts. But everyone else is bowing down. Now Haman himself is bowing down to Esther. And we saw about the Esther-Mordechai unit, right? So we begin with everybody bowing except Mordechai to Haman. By the end of the Megillah, Haman is bowing down before Esther. And then finally, the parak concludes, Haman's life concludes, Vayeslu Haman ala Eitz Asher Yechil LeMordechai, V'Chamas HaMelech Shachacha. and the rage of the king, right, subsides. So the Gemara comments on this, that shachacha, why the double chach? Shtei shchichos alolama, achas malko shal olam, achas shal achashverosh. Then we have the removal of Haman, so the rage of HaKadosh Baruch Hu subsides as well. Esther Rabbah just says, doesn't even give any credit to Achashverosh. It just says, the king, the real king, right? Hamas HaMelech Shachacha. The existence of Haman, everything that Haman stands for, the ego, the greed, the demands, the rage, the self-obsession, right? Which unfortunately, in a narcissistic society, we can see not to quite a Haman degree, but some of those character traits, there's no question that we can identify. People who are all into themselves, people who give themselves credit for everything, people who feel the need for more and more and can't say thank you, can't appreciate, can't recognize anything else in their lives, can't recognize any higher causes, that is a trigger for Hamas HaMelech. And when that is gone, that antithesis of the humility and the modesty, right? Hashem is the one who is hidden the entire time. Esther ben Hator Minayim, the Gemara asks. How do I know about Esther? The answer was Hasteir Esther Panayim Ekem. Hashem hides. Hashem's modest. Hashem's retiring. When Haman is gone, Hamas HaMelech Shachacha, the anger of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to subside. So that note, we'll stop here. I hope you all enjoyed tonight and the series. And Mirz Hashem, everybody should have a wonderful, happy, and healthy burn.
Thank you.